Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about movies and wine, and for those of you out there who don't know shit about one or the other topic, my name is Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
Welcome!
That was delayed gratification.
You explained this to me a few weeks ago. What is it called?
Aerating.
I was aerating in my mouth.
You were blowing bubbles in your own mouth.
I was sucking bubbles in my...
It's bad.
Anyway, he's Jamie. Whatever. I'm Scott. It's fine. We're here to help or something. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves.
Wow, Scott. The energy just like deflated
out of
you.
It's fine, Jamie. It's fine.
Just
everything's
right
everything's
out of you.
Fine. Hey, Jamie.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring you down. Ready?
Don't do
Clarence
it.
Clarence Thomas.
Shut the fuck up.
I'm Scott, and I'm the movie guy, and we're here to help you. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves.
We tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. We almost never do.
It would be a shock if this was one that did work. I don't think it will.
I think in a preliminary kind of way.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I like the idea.
I like it on paper.
And I like it thinking about the... Anyway, we'll get into it.
We'll get there.
Today, we're starting a brand new miniseries. We talk so much about food on this show, and apparently I don't give Scott pairing suggestions in advance of our recordings, that I thought we should talk about the thing that's supposed to go with wine. Food. So I put together a list of some of my favorite Philly restaurants and contacted the owners to see what dishes they wanted to showcase. What follows over the next 6 episodes is... a Philadelphia tasting menu.
Mm. Jamie, you're very good at reading the script here because you didn't course correct yourself because it's the next 6 episodes, plural.
I know. I tripped over it.
That's okay.
It happens. I'm not doing it again. We're not doing another take.
Oh, and I have to cut out that little side thing there because I just credited you for reading something.
You.
So that just all has to go. That can't be part of the canon of the show.
I can read, okay? Can read.
Okay, sure. Well, on the movie side of things, I picked 6 movies that in one way or another explore the power of food, specifically meals that are shared. But in theory, each of these pairs to the wine and not to the dish that Jamie is pairing a wine to.
Right.
So I want to set the stakes very clearly.
It's like a whisper down the lane
thing. Let's do a verbal Venn diagram. So you started with food.
Right.
You got 6 dishes. Uh-huh. And then to those 6 dishes, you paired 1 wine each.
Right.
And then in a separate circle that only overlaps with wine, but that's not with the food,
correct.
I paired movies to that, but not to the food.
That's right.
But to have any kind of thematic relevance and connection to what you're doing, I picked movies that were about food. Because I wasn't going to pick movies that are about Philadelphia, because it would be just like the same fucking dozen movies that everybody picks when they want to do anything about Philadelphia movies.
That's right. Or we would just watch selected episodes from It's Always Sunny.
Jamie, this is not a podcast about wine and long-running FX comedy series. It's just not what we are. People might listen if we were the It's Always Sunny podcast, but I'm sure there's a bunch of those.
I'm certain there are several very bad ones and maybe one passable one.
Well, someone will have to tell me about it.
Yeah. So for our first dish, I went to El Mercury owner Sofia De Leon. El Mercury is a fast casual Guatemalan restaurant that serves up some truly great handmade street food, including notably papusas and churros.
Now, can you help the audience out here just on the Googling front?
What papusas and churros are?
No. Just tell them how El Mercury is spelled.
That's smart. Look at you.
Just trying to help people out here.
El Mercury is spelled ELMERKURY.
There you go.
Mercury with a K.
Work that SEO magic, y'all.
Damn right. So we ate some pork papusas earlier, and I think they're quite dope. I think Scott agrees.
They were quite dope. They're gone now.
Gone but not forgotten. It's worth noting that with a little notice, the folks at El Mercury will make you a custom churro cake, which is absolutely something everyone should experience.
Now, this is the most important thing that we will discuss today. Tell everyone about the churro cake, because we had the churros and the chocolate cherry dipping sauce, which was outstanding earlier. But tell people about the cake.
The cake, I have not experienced the cake, but it's a thing that I'm looking for an excuse in my life to purchase a cake and eat the whole thing myself and share none with anybody.
Right.
Which is a bit that I'm stealing from what you said earlier.
I said this 45 minutes ago and you're just like staring at me, daring me to call you out for stealing what I said verbatim.
That's correct. Yes. So they bake a layer cake And then essentially structurally support it around the edges with churros. And you can do like custom filling and custom icing and like custom writing on top. And it sounds like exactly what I would want for a celebration of really any kind.
It sounds like a great last meal for you, Jamie.
I mean, we're coming up on it. The arteries are filling up daily. You know what I'm saying?
I thought you were like on death row or something, and I just didn't know.
So for the pupusas, I chose a wine from Germany. This wine is from the good folks at Von Winning, spelled with a W, like winning, Von Winning. This is in the Pfalz. I chose their Sauvignon Blanc 2 bottling. That's Roman numeral 2. This is the 2020 vintage, available at wine.com currently as of the date of this recording, for $24.
Now, James, you told me that the Von Winning was crisp, mineral, joyful, somehow related to the effects of climate change, and that it had grassy fields or notes of grassy fields.
That is correct, yes.
And to all of that, some of which is helpful and some of which was not, I paired a little movie called After Yang. This is one of my favorite movies of 2022 thus far. It is from writer-director Koganada and distributor A24. After Yang is currently available for your streaming pleasure on Showtime, or you can rent it wherever you get your VODs. Now, before we get into it with movie, with wine, and a little bit with food, we do have some business to attend to. So, in our recent campaign to hopefully solicit more reviews from our listenership that are definitely listening and not so much reviewing, I have been doing a carrot and a stick thing. The carrot, if you guys leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you listen to your podcast, that'll allow you to leave reviews. And in that review, tell us your favorite Marvel movie. I will make Jamie watch it. The stick, if we don't have a new review for every episode, I will regale all of you and Jamie begrudgingly with the latest in the ongoing saga of renovating my bathroom. And I have plenty of bathroom updates, but
it's true. I already got all of them.
I pulled my butt, Mike. Everybody. We'll have, I'm going to have to write this down so I don't forget.
Find a different way to say that.
I pulled both halves of my butt.
Okie dokie.
It's like a muscle in your butt. I pulled it and I pulled both of them.
There are more than one muscles in my butt.
I pulled it.
Okay.
Anyway, we'll save that for another day, for a rainy day when we don't have reviews, because today we do have a new review.
We do.
But before we get into that, last time, both Adrian and Tani in their reviews suggested that Jamie watch Thor Ragnarok. And Jamie, the floor is yours. What were your thoughts on your first Marvel Cinematic Universe entry unwillingly foisted upon you by this show?
It was fine. It's okay. It's
a lot of fun. It's got a lot of Jamie energy.
On paper, that's the thing. That's the thing that I kept having to contend with.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the things on screen and the things that people are saying and the tones that everyone's taking, and I'm like, this should be exactly what I want.
Right.
It's pretty irreverent. They do a lot of comedy. There are dumb jokes aplenty.
It has Jeff Goldblum being like a weird sex pirate. Not pirate.
He also, by the way, he didn't do more than one take for any scene that he's in.
I'm sure he did more than one take.
Cut, print, fuck you.
I do think he just showed up and that was his wardrobe. I feel like all the production design for his planet is just based around, oh, this is what Jeff is wearing today. All right, cool.
Yeah, it's... I mean, part of it, I'm sure, is that I'm like fully not invested in any of the ongoing story.
Right.
Like the last Marvel movie that I watched was, I believe, Black Panther.
Which came out a year after this.
Right.
And has nothing to do with this
movie. But I had not watched anything prior to that since Captain America and the Winter Soldier.
So you had seen the Winter Soldier. Other favorite Marvel movie.
Well, that was the one where I fully lost interest.
Yeah.
That was the one where I tapped out. I was like, these all fucking look and feel the same, and it's like I'm watching just a serialized television show, and if I want to do that, I'll watch fucking TV. And so I stopped entirely. And so now Thor Ragnarok, or fucking whatever.
You were a little bit ahead of the curve on that one. I'll give you credit.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
We'll get to it at some point, I'm sure. But I think the first two thirds of Ragnarok are actually pretty good. And then the last battle, for as much fun as it is, it's just like, Asgard, it's a people, not a place. The fuck?
Right.
This movie doesn't care about the people or the place. Like, what are you talking about?
We spend this does exactly not resolve zero this. Time with the people at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine.
It's fun. It's got good vibes. The first two thirds, great vibes.
I'm not mad about it, but I'm mad about it in that it's a thing that captivates a lot of people's attention and a thing that is economically dominant.
Mm-hmm.
Like if it were just a thing that existed and was like kind of successful, I'd be like, yeah, that's fine. But like it's this fucking phenom, mm-hmm. and it's just fine. Like you people need to be better.
Jamie, they keep getting more just fine as the mega franchise goes on.
It's bland. It's not bland.
That movie is not bland.
It's candy colored and there's a lot of vibes, as you say.
There's a lot of vibes. Hemsworth is having a great time.
He is.
Fucking drunk Tessa Thompson is great. Ruffalo drunk shows
Tessa
up.
Tessa Thompson is fine.
I really like her in that movie. I think she's a lot of fun.
Cate Blanchett
just being like a drag queen the whole time is incredible, and then is yet another Marvel villain where it's like, wow, we're going to get one of the greatest actors in the world. And like, at least she gets to have a personality.
Right.
But then ultimately that character doesn't really have any weight at all.
No, and gets killed by someone who is like an afterthought in the very beginning of the movie. Like, yeah. What?
Yeah.
What?
You know my biggest grievance with that movie? It sets up, this is just like the classic Marvel thing where like it sets up a great character conflict and then throws it away for a joke. So like, did you know that Hulk was in it?
No.
You must be one of the only people on the planet who actually got to enjoy that surprise.
Yeah.
Because that whole reveal is in the trailers. And I was just like, God, this would have been such a great thing for an audience to actually be surprised by.
Well, they telegraph it a little in the movie. Like as you're setting up for the reveal, it's like, okay, they have deliberately not told me something. This is going to be something shocking. And
right.
It's either going to be completely unthreatening to Thor, or it's going to be some kind of an emotional whatever. So yeah, I was excited.
It's a nice surprise. And then Hemsworth's reaction, the big yes, and he's a friend from work. Very funny. That was a great trailer moment, and it just landed like a wet thud in a theater.
Yep.
And then he reverts back to Banner. And Banner's whole thing is that, like, I don't want to turn back into Hulk because I don't think I'll ever be able to come back again. Like, sets up a great dramatic conflict for him. And then his choice at the end needs to be, I have to Hulk out. I'm going to jump out of the plane and go down and save everybody. And he does it. And then it's a joke because he falls and gets seriously injured. And then it's just a laugh. And we never comment upon it for the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
He's just Hulk the entire rest of the time. And those emotional stakes have vanished. For a joke, which is a good joke.
It's not a bad joke.
But like a movie would deal with those dramatic stakes that it set up.
Yeah.
That's so fucking predictable.
The tone
with this
whiplash
show.
Too. Like, and I'm one who kind of likes tone, not kind of. I very much am in favor on record as loving a change in tone or like a dramatic stakes with irreverent attitude.
Yeah.
But I feel like this movie doesn't really understand how to walk that line. Anytime the drama gets amped up and it becomes serious, I feel like I have been laughing and shouldn't have. And then it switches back to funny and I'm left thinking like that the drama is unresolved.
Yeah. Well, cause it is. Cause right. The drama is entirely unresolved.
Yeah. I'm not mad about it, except that it's a fucking multimedia phenom. Yeah. It's fucking fine. And all you people out there who absolutely love it, like, I don't understand you, but whatever.
It's fine. People love tone. Tone is powerful. That's what the whole Marvel factory has built its success upon, is on tone and likable characters who are well cast. And it doesn't matter if we don't do anything dramatically interesting or challenging with them. Boy, you are really going to struggle because this is among the high watermarks of the franchise.
Motherfucker.
Like, I really thought this was going to appeal to you in a huge way because of its big, like, middle finger that it just waves in the air.
It waves a big middle
time.
Finger. And I was struggling with that the whole time. The fact that, because on paper, I should love this movie because it is my tone and it has that fuck you energy.
And predictable. It would have been at least nice if we disagreed about one movie over the course of this show. Well, it's all downhill from here. So Thor Ragnarok's swing and a miss for Jamie, but we have other things coming up. So we have another new review. Thank you very much. This is from a friend of the show, Rebecca. What is Rebecca's Apple username?
It was shit.
It's a good Apple username.
Star Kraken.
And her review on the Apple Pods titled Chaotic Good Energy, which I think is a pretty good subtitle for this show.
It's a good compliment.
Yeah.
I like it.
Chaotic good. I personally feel like I'm more of a lawful neutral myself, but the show chaotic good or chaotic neutral. But here is her review. Thank you very much, Rebecca. This show is a delightful font of the kind of intellectual bickering that is born from knowing each other so well and for so long. And sometimes they even learn from each other. That is not true. As a wine novice, Jamie's explanations really help me expand my palate and explore wines that I usually wouldn't bother with. Also, there's stuff about movies. But Scott likes The Batman, so that's a shame. But other than
that...
Got
him.
Yeah, she got me good. You're not alone, Jamie. There are dozens of you. But other than that glaring lapse of judgment on his part, Scott has a deep well of knowledge about filmmaking and the industry overall that continues to impress. Also, and this is her suggestion for what Jamie has to watch, Green Lantern.
Now, I don't know much about Green Lantern, but I'm pretty sure that, first of all, that's a DC Universe character.
You are correct. He originated in the pages of Detective Comics comics.
So it kind of doesn't qualify for our ask here.
I'm going to allow this one, Jamie.
Why are you the fucking arbiter?
Because you certainly can't be,
God,
all right?
Damn it.
I overruled Tani's suggestion about...
A television show.
About Agent Carter, because it was a television show. But this one, I sustain this objection. This one passes.
Fuck.
Or maybe, no, I guess I'm overruling your objection, Jamie.
And this is fucking Ryan Reynolds, right?
Oh, this movie is terrible.
Oh, God.
When I saw this review, I texted Rebecca and like, you're a maniac. She's like, does it count? I know it's not Marvel. I'm like, it counts. It's fine. And then I realized that, oh, God, I guess I have to watch this with you. And then it occurred to me, actually, I don't. I don't have to watch it with you.
You're a fucking dick.
Oh, it's egregiously terrible. There's like maybe 10 minutes where it's like, oh, this is like a space-bound, super exciting, like Green Lantern movie. And there's like a ton of aliens and it's cool and it's weird. And it's like got all the Green Lantern core and all Kilowog and like a squid wearing a Green Lantern ring and all kinds of fun stuff. But like a good hour in the middle of the movie is just like Ryan Reynolds, like not accepting the call to action for like the hero's journey. Oh, it's so bad. And then he fights a cloud at the end. So Jamie has to watch.
I'm super fucking excited.
Green Lantern.
Rebecca, we have not seen each other in 20 some odd years. And I always have fond memories of you. But fuck you for this.
You're going to have a different song to sing about Thor Ragnarok after this, Jamie. So Green Lantern, Jamie, is on HBO Max.
Great.
It is. Wow, I remember it being so much longer than that. It's only 1 hour and 54 minutes long.
That was the fucking Ragnarok goes on. It felt like much longer than 2 hours and 13 minutes.
They all do. So yeah, if you enjoyed this segment of Jamie shit talking on popular things and me sometimes agreeing with him, please leave us a review if you haven't done so yet. You can do it on the Apple Pods. You can do it on many of the other podcatchers. If you are an international listener to this show, somebody listening outside the US, and we know that some of you are, and if you leave us a review, especially on the Apple Pods, Apple won't tell us about it. So just like email it to us and let us know and we'll read that on the air. And Jamie will have to watch
your
Captain America Civil War, a movie that's about nothing.
Great.
A very fun nothing of a movie, though.
I'm down for fun. I like fun.
This is less fun than Thor Ragnarok.
Okay, well, then
there is also a gigantic fight between a ton of heroes, like basically in a parking lot, and the color gray is the dominant color in this movie's like color theory.
Good.
But nobody suggested that yet. You have to watch Green Lantern first. Jamie, tell me about the food. We just ate the food.
Yeah. So I introed the food a little bit at the beginning. El Mercury, spelled with a K. In Philadelphia, there are two locations, one at 21st and Chestnut and the other in Reading Terminal Market. They both produce essentially the same menu. They do pupusas and tostadas, and taquitos, as well as a couple of salads and some really great sides. As we experienced today, their guacamole has like a totally different style to it and is really delicious.
Yo, it's like a next level guac.
Yeah.
We were talking about it. It's not like congealed and thick, and it's lower fat, more citrus. It's more like a green salsa almost.
Right.
Beautiful. It has really like nice
enough richness from the avocado, but like you can fill yourself up on the guacamole that we're all used to. That is basically all avocado. This is more like a snack or an appetizer.
Well, it's like actually a dip.
Right.
Yeah, it's the thing that you dip your chip into, whereas traditional guac that we think of is like chips are the thing that you serve your guac on, essentially.
That's right.
It reorients the priorities is what I'm saying.
The thing that I paired this wine with, though, is the pork pupusas that they make. Sophia, the owner, gave me a little quote on her pupusas. She says, so while pupusas are seemingly simple, stuffed corn dumplings, every part of it is made from scratch. The masa, we grind the corn ourselves, the braised chicharron inside, the fresh salsa, the pickled cilantro cabbage, and the onion that go on top. Everything is fresh made. Fresh ground masa, for me, is one of those like great pleasures. The first time I had a fresh made tortilla, it was like a revelation, because like whatever corn tortillas you get in a bag or at most restaurants pale in comparison. That like fresh corn flavor is something really special. And it's something that I think that is like prominent in the flavor profile of these pupusas. What did you think about them?
It was nummy. I enjoyed them.
Yeah.
Yeah. The filling, the meatly, porkly filling. What did you say? It was a braised.
It's a braised chicharron. So chicharrons are typically like deep fried and puffed, like pork skin, almost like a chip. Mm. And they get salted, and you crunch on them as sort of like an easy snack,
like a crackling.
But rather than deep frying them, these get braised, and they represent the filling. So it's fatty and substantial against that like fresh corn.
Yeah, it was a nice balance of flavors. It was a little milder than I expected, and not like in a bad way, but it wasn't overwhelmingly spiced or seasoned. But it had a nice balance of like the corn. The texture was very nice. I really enjoyed the savory meatiness, but then, man, all those toppings that go on top of it just really bring the whole thing to life. Though those pickled red onions, that like beautiful pink color that they came out.
Fucking pickled red onions are among my favorite things in the whole world. Just like, give me forkfuls of them.
The cabbage was good.
Yep.
The red salsa was super good.
The red salsa had such good depth of flavor and like exactly the right spice level.
Yeah, and then you kind of mix all those together, put a little sprinkling on top there. It was even good just like with a little spoonful of the guac on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were delicious. Next time I'm in Center City, I'm going to pop over there and grab those.
And for those of you not—
And a churro cake.
The churro cake.
I want a churro cake.
And you're going to eat the whole thing.
Yeah. I'll share it with my son. I'm not a monster, Jamie.
For those of you who are not pork inclined, they also do more than one vegetarian option for the pupusas. But I chose the pork one because Sophia chose the pork one, probably because she thinks, and rightly so, it is the most popular because it's fucking delicious and pigs are delicious.
Super, super nums.
Yeah.
But we disagreed when we talked about it while we were eating off mic, which nobody really wanted to hear. And that was a good choice not to eat on mic. I don't know how much I think the wine went with it. You clocked it. And I agree that the wine goes extremely well with the guac. The citrus in that guac in particular goes really nicely with that, like that crisp and fruit forward and citrusy wine. But I don't know how well it went with the pupusa.
Not
to blow up your spot here.
Yeah, here you go, blowing up my spot.
Well, I'm just like not as invested in this part. Like, I feel bad about this. When I say that you like fucked up a pairing for the movie, like, fuck you. You should have done your job. But like, I don't want to put you on the spot here. I feel bad. I love the pupusa and I love the wine.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know how much they're doing the magic for me when they're coming together.
I think they do a lot. I think, as we said before, you've got this pupusa with the crunchy, onions and cabbage on top, and this wine, which without food is pretty vegetal. It's got that like jalapeno grassy fields kind of thing going on. And then with the food changes into something that is more fruit and mineral driven.
Oh, that is true. I did keenly observe that the minerality came out.
Correct.
After I had taken a bite.
I am a proponent of drinking white wine with pork. I think it just really goes very well together. And a lot of people tend to think of pork as like this deep, dark thing that needs red wine. And for sure, it does go with red wine. But
who would think that?
Plenty of people.
Look at pork.
I know. It's the other white meat.
Just look at it.
I know.
Deep,
but
there
are people who, you know, just favor red wine overall. And so like any excuse to drink wine, there's that. But also, you know, pork can withstand some of those deeper, darker flavors. Like if you do like a coffee rub on it or braise it even, it can be easy to think that you need tannin from red wine for it. I disagree.
Yeah, that feels like a mistake.
And I think the freshness of this wine complements the freshness of the corn in the outside part of the pupusa. I thought it was a very successful pairing. You know, it maybe isn't my best one. And obviously, like I will agree with you, the guacamole is a better pair for this wine. The guacamole is more cilantro heavy, more citrus heavy. And I think those things really sing with this wine.
I mean, it could just also be that my limited definition of what like a successful food wine pairing is, which we don't really talk about too often, but like you, cause sometimes when you do pairings, and we'll get into this later, but like you're doing contrapuntal pairings.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, like this feels successful with the guac because there's some, but not all notes that are mirrored between them.
Right.
Whereas you're finding success in the pairing for the ways that they're different and how those differences highlight things within each other.
Correct. Yeah. And how the experience changes is the other thing. The experience of the wine and the food are different together than they are apart. It is good that these alterations have been made.
Okay. That was my question.
Yeah.
So that's a feature, not a bug.
Correct. Yes. I mean, unless you're talking about a food that makes a wine feel like overly alcoholic and just like boozy and unpleasant.
Well, like this wine, I had a little sip of this while we were noshing on some churros and it was
super bad.
Extremely not good.
Yep.
Yeah. Thanks for the warning, dick.
Drink dessert wine with dessert. Your dessert wine should be as sweet or sweeter than the food you're eating it with. That's just a general rule of thumb. You can break it in some circumstances. Obviously, knowing the rules is the key to breaking them successfully, but like that's the general rule of thumb. And yeah, Sauvignon Blanc and cinnamon-covered churros with chocolate sauce, super fucking bad
with
pairing.
With like a chocolate cherry sauce?
Yeah, it's bad.
Yo, but that chocolate cherry sauce is
bomb.
So wild. And immediately, my first thought was like, oh no, what? Oh, wait. And then it became something special.
Mm-hmm.
Does not go with Sauvy B. That was a mistake.
Yeah.
Speaking of
Sauvy B,
the Sauvy B, I fucking hate you. Take me away from the area that I'm less comfortable with, which is talking about food, and take me into an area that I'm somehow more comfortable talking about, which is wine. This is very unexpected. I realize you asked me like, what did you think of the food? And suddenly I felt uncertain. And now that we're talking about wine again,
now
I feel
more comfortable.
I feel the ground beneath my feet. What the fuck?
It's weird, right? It's wild.
Yeah, this mega numbs.
Yeah, I'm glad you like it.
I feel like already I'm more comfortable with where we're going after the last miniseries, just because
this is
it's nice to get off on the right foot and just enjoy a wine.
Yeah, talk to me.
So on the smell, as always, white wine, pineapple. This is my regular old wine smell. The child insists, and he's like, I'm not doing a bit. It's really regular old wine smell. I'm like, all right, whatever, kid. But no, definitely pineapple. Some kind of a vegetative thing, even on the schnuffer. I'm a little surprised by it. Smelling some kind of leafy things. All right, acidity, we would say medium acidity.
You think medium?
Do you think medium
I think,
plus?
I think medium plus.
I'm not salivating too. I guess I'm salivating a little bit. And is the acidity leading to the brightness? Because it's bright.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And it's zingy, too. And
zesty.
Zesty. Is it a little bit in the realm of laser beams? Pew, pew, pew?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
and
not
that's
like
the acidity is laser beams.
That like linearity that carries it down your palate, like in a straight line, which is what linear means.
You
I know.
Keep,
stop
you keep
it.
Saying,
just
no.
Shut up.
No, I just, you keep saying.
Shut up.
No, you keep saying. Linearity, it carries it down your palate in a straight line. And I'm not critiquing your, you know, defining a word that you just said, but as though that means anything to me still. And it does not.
It does not. I know.
You are describing apparently a sensation that I am having, and it sounds like you're describing, you know, something else. Body, this is medium minus body. It's not light, But no, there's yeah, a little bit of grip. A
little bit.
Yeah. Not tannic, obviously, but is it low astringency? It's not. Yeah. It has a little bit of texture
to it. Yeah. But nothing. It's not gripping onto the sides of your mouth at all.
Yeah, it smells great. Oh, there's like a green bell pepper kind of a thing, or maybe mm-hmm. it's red bell pepper. No, because green bell pepper is less sweet. But definitely like a bell pepper type of thing.
Yep.
Where are we on the alcohol? Are we 12? 12.5 maybe on this one?
Pretty sure it's 12.5.
The bottle is right there. I don't look at it.
I've got my face in front of the microphone and I don't want to like move. Can you see it?
12.5. I declare it to be 12.5. And sweet. It's medium sweetness. It is neither dry nor sweet.
This is a dry wine.
How? This is not dry. Why are there...
We're going to get there one day.
So I'm not tasting sweetness right now.
That is correct.
I don't understand.
There's very, very little sugar in this wine.
I'm so confused.
I know.
I still don't understand.
And I don't know how to more clearly articulate for you what the difference is between flavors that are redolent of sweet things and actual sugar.
Jamie, climb down off the cross, okay? This is not your burden to bear.
I'm trying out here, but this is the one consistently not a sweet wine.
At all?
Nope.
So it's dry.
That is right.
Is it bone dry?
No, dry.
Fine. Well, it's good. There's some zing. Yep. There's some laser beams, some citrus, a little bit of tropical, like of a pineapple thing, as always. Something kind of vegetative, like in the ballpark of like a tomato leaf kind of thing, especially on the nose. Something leafy.
I mean, for me, it's freshly cut grass and green bell pepper. And like maybe verging into jalapeno territory is like the vegetal area that
we're like in. Jalapeno without the spice, without the heat.
You're not getting the spice, but that like if you cut into a fresh jalapeno, that like pop of aroma that you get.
I avoid jalapenos. I don't really cook with hot peppers at
jalapenos
all.
Jalapenos are delicious.
I have a very weak tolerance for spicy. I need it to be like super white people mild. I just can't. Like I enjoy it. But like when I'm cooking, I also don't know how to calibrate. And like the handful of times that like I've tried to use jalapenos or something, it's like, oh, fuck, everything tastes too bad. And why are my eyes burning? And I just like it's.
Well, yeah. And also jalapenos are difficult to gauge because they change from fruit to fruit.
Yeah.
Like each pepper has a different spice level.
Yeah. Father Bird over yonder there, one time he grew jalapenos in the yard over by the pool, and we made like jalapeno poppers from it. And like you take a bite of one and it's like, oh, this is nice. And it's just like a little bit of burn. And then you take a bite of another one and it's like, oh, you got a ghost pepper in there somehow. And it was just like from plant to plant. It was crazy. Yep, totally the disparity. Different.
Yeah. That's what I get here. This for me is like just beautiful, mineral driven, a little bit vegetal white wine. This is great on its own, but like a perfect aperitif wine, something to start a meal off with. Something with canapes or like the first course of a meal or whatever. It's good with seafood. It's good. I mean, I think it was really good with the pupusas. But as you say, much better with the guacamole.
It'd be nice with a soup.
Good with like.
Be nice with like a watermelon springtime. Gazpacho with like some lime and a little cilantro. Bit of cilantro on top and some salt, some sea salt. Yeah, that'd be real good.
It'd be super, super yummy.
All right, I got to make a watermelon gazpacho soon.
Gazpacho.
I just like saying gazpacho.
Everybody likes saying gazpacho.
I've never made a gazpacho. I keep threatening to, especially a watermelon gazpacho. Because my wife loves watermelon, and I like saying gazpacho.
And watermelon season is upon us, my friend.
It is nigh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This winery has been a perennial favorite of mine. I actually had the good pleasure of tasting through their lineup at a portfolio tasting this past week. So I got to meet their import manager for the second or third time, and I was wearing my Jägermeister shirt, and he's German, so loved the Jägermeister shirt.
Jägermeister is disgusting.
If you drink it not like a stupid college person, it's pretty yummy.
Does that
you
change would probably the flavor?
Well, listen, if you're not just gulping down a shot of it, or worse, dropping it into Red Bull and chugging that.
I've never done that.
But if you drink it like it's an Amaro, like a digestif at the end of a meal, if you have a taste for that, I have a feeling you would hate all Amaro.
I feel like I've had Amaros and have enjoyed them, but I've had Jaeger and have never enjoyed it.
When was the last time you had Jaeger?
A number of years ago.
Some like 20 years ago?
No, Jamie, I didn't have Jaeger.
When you were 17, 20 years ago?
Sometime at a bar. I had Jaeger at some point, and it was gross.
So it was 15 years ago.
Probably you fucking serving it,
Absolutely
too.
Not.
You smug shit.
That is, I mean, that last part is true, but the first part where I served it was not.
Yeah. It wouldn't have been like at that one New Year's party or whatever at Sarah's where you showed up and you were the life of the party for 45 minutes and then you threw up for the next 6 hours?
No, because that was Jameson, my friend. That was 13 shots in a row of Jameson
that was
down
so
my
much Jameson.
Stupid fucking gullet.
And then I drew a blue dick on your forehead.
Yeah, you sure did. Those were good times.
That was a good one. I still have a picture. You were so unhappy the next morning because you were hungover, and also it was with Sharpie and you couldn't erase it.
We were young and dumb.
Yeah.
Now we're old and dumb.
Yeah.
And we're drinking this wine, which is delicious. And it's from Germany. It's from a region called the Pfalz. P-F-A-L-Z. Pfalz.
The Pfalz in our stars.
The Pfalz in, I don't know what stars is in Germany or in German. I would do a German thing. But
it's fine. It's nothing. I'm going to cut that out. I made a reference to a movie based on a book, neither of which I've seen nor read.
One of the things that I really like about this wine is the forward thinking nature of planting Sauvignon Blanc where they have it planted. So this is a vineyard that they call Paradise Garden, which translates to Garden of Paradise. One of those nice, like, conjugates in German.
I see on the outline here. Yeah. You had someone write this for you, that Paradise Garden, one word.
Paradise Garden, yeah.
Right. Translates to, coincidentally, hellscape. Paradise Garden.
So it's a Premier Cru vineyard. It's recognized by the government as one of the best vineyards and recognized by all the winemakers around as well. And inside of Von Winning's holdings, they decided to plant some Sauvignon Blanc. Because Sauvignon Blanc is a warmer climate varietal, and they are thinking to the future of their region.
It's again with the climate change.
Listen, man.
Again with the climate change.
You said it at the top. We were, you know, the pairing words that I gave you. Again. This is the effects of a warming climate.
Again with the climate change.
Listen.
You're praising them for the climate change?
They are making lemonade out of the lemons they were given.
I'm really glad for them. I hope that they figure out what to make out of the nothing they'll be given when, you know, all plant life on the planet has to adapt and photosynthesis doesn't work anymore.
Listen, man, we're trying to be positive about a very negative thing. And we know that it exists and we can't just like not think about it at all. And so we plant warmer climate varieties in places that are historically colder climate.
And this is Riesling country.
This is Riesling country.
Because it's Germany.
That's right. Well, because it's the Pfalz specifically. Pfalz, Rheingau, Rheinhessen, Mosel, Nahe, those are the Riesling regions of Germany. And then you have other regions like the two in the north whose names I always fucking forget, except when I'm actively preparing for an exam, and then Württemberg and Baden in the south that are more famous for red wine. You know, there are other grapes planted in Germany, but Riesling is dominant because we all think of Riesling when we think of Germany. Or rather, we think of Germany when we think of Riesling, I think is more accurate.
No, I think when you think of Germany, you think of Riesling.
That's true. Extraordinarily true. So they're, you know, making lemonade out of lemons. And I appreciate it. And I think the wines are spectacular.
It's pretty good lemonade.
Yeah. I mean, they do that. This is the fully stainless steel fermented one that's supposed to be just like light and easy drinking and sort of reminiscent of Sancerre. And I think this hits on everything that Sancerre promises in a better way than Sancerre does currently.
All right. You've now said Sancerre three times. Yep. You are obligated to briefly explain what that is.
Sancerre is a Sauvignon Blanc-centric region in the central Loire Valley that is famous and promises wines like this, but in the 2010s and 2020s creates wines that are way too high in alcohol and overly blown out, and you know it's too hot there. But they make this one, which is stainless steel fermented. They also do a barrel fermented and aged one. That's the Sauvignon Blanc 1, that is like really very textured and a little richer and has those oak tones to it, while still having like this really piercing acidity. That one is like $45 retail a bottle, and is something truly special.
That sounds good.
Fucking beautiful.
This with a little bit of oak and a little bit more texture.
Yeah.
I feel like I could get down on that.
Basic. Yeah. That's essentially, and I think that you would like it. I think it's right up your alley. It's super fucking good.
So you're saying that these guys are future thinking.
Yeah.
How long have they been planting Sauvignon Blanc in the faults?
To be honest, I don't know. And I tried to find out when this planting got there. I even asked the export manager when I was at the tasting, and he couldn't give me a direct answer because he's not the viticulturalist or the winemaker. But as long as I've been dealing with them, which has been the last 7 years, they've been making this wine. So at least 3 years prior to that, because it takes 3 years to produce fruit from a newly planted vine. Minimum 10 years, these vines have been there.
Noted climate change expert that you are. You're not a doctor. You're not a comedian. You're not a anthropologist.
I'm not an engineer.
You're not an engineer, but you are a climate change expert.
I'm not a climate change expert.
You talk about it often enough. How far into the past in the world of wine would Sauvy B from this region not have tasted like this? We're talking like 10 years, 20 years.
You're probably talking about the early 90s and prior would have been like an era where they would have struggled to get these grapes ripe enough to make viable wine other than sparkling wine.
Because it was just too damn cold.
Right.
All right, now prognosticating, how long do they have before they can't make this anymore because it's like overripe or underripe and it's too high alcohol and too fruit forward because it's too damn hot?
I'm not going to wager a guess.
All right, last question. How long before the Arctic is making some really spot on Sauvignon Blanc?
Well, never, because the Arctic is just an ice cap and not a landmass.
All right. Things within the Arctic Circle, Jamie, like northern Greenland or something.
There's not much land up there. But I don't know. Let's call it 50 years and then, you know, it'll probably be 25 or whatever.
Good.
Yeah.
It's real good.
Super good.
This wine, however.
Super yummy.
Very tasty.
Yeah. It's real good. Yeah. I fucking love it. I think it's a lot of fun. I think that y'all should drink it. And I'm glad that you like it.
Me too. I'm really glad that I like it.
I think you're going to like most of the wines in this miniseries.
I was just like, by the end of that last miniseries, I was just nervous. Like every time you'd open a bottle, I'm like, all right, fucking here it comes.
Although I do love
going to be some more gross weirdness.
That angry text that I got from you when you drank the second bottle of Kota 45.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You sent me some angry text messages about how you think you like that wine now.
Nope, that can't possibly be true.
Let's read the transcript.
Nope, this didn't happen. I don't even think I have a second bottle of Kota 45.
You did have a second bottle and you drank it. Yep. Let's see. How far back?
This was Friday.
This thing that didn't happen was Friday?
I'm cutting that part out to speed through the part where I have to wait for you to find it.
So it starts with, God damn you, I'm drinking the Kota 45. And I say, and are you enjoying it? I don't know, in all caps.
Yeah, so
I'm smiling so hard right now. Scott returns with, again in all caps, shut up.
I guess I like the Kota 45.
I'm so glad. You were beaten into submission by it.
I was. It compelled me. I reluctantly concede I like the Kota 45.
I'm smiling a lot.
It came around.
It makes me happy.
Shut up.
I like it. I like that wine so much. I poured it at Winework this past Monday.
Did everyone yell at you and ask for their money back?
The people love that wine, Scott.
Well, these are like people who come out because they find and they love the Jamie show,
they
too.
They do love the Jamie. You love the
these
Jamie show,
despite your protestations.
These are a bunch of Fernet drinkers. I poured definitely 3/4 of a bottle of Fernet that night also.
So gross. So gnarly.
I fucking love Fernet.
All right.
If you drink Fernet, we're friends. Just saying.
Well, I don't.
That doesn't mean that we're not friends.
It feels like it does.
There isn't like a negative, like if you don't drink Fernet, we're not friends. That's not a thing.
Maybe there should be.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Are we ready to talk about this movie?
Are you now? Ready,
Jude? I'm ready
You've
to talk
been
about
talking
about
Fernet and Kota 45 for like half an hour now.
And also the Sauvignon Blanc that I very much like I'm enjoying.
Soup's nums.
And I'm excited to share with you the rest of the wines in this miniseries. and also to talk about After Yang, which, spoilers, I really like a lot.
It's really good. It's extremely good. I thought for a hot minute about trying to pick things this miniseries just to shake things up that would be a little bit more provocative to you. But, like, I just don't want to, and I want the audience to enjoy things, and I want to enjoy things as well. So, fuck you. I picked things that you'll like. You're welcome.
Thank you.
After Yang is a 2022 film. This is the second from writer-director Koganada, lowercase k. One name, like Cher or Madonna, Koganada, lowercase k. Who is a video essayist about film and filmmakers. His first film, 2017's Columbus, was one of the breakouts at that year's Sundance, and it was among the best-reviewed movies of that year. His follow-up, After Yang, takes his existential themes and his kind of, like, architectural aesthetic that he brought to Columbus, which is, like, a movie that is largely about architecture, into sort of like a soft sci-fi setting. It's based on a short story by Alexander Weinstein. After Yang follows the Fleming family. Dad Jake, played by Colin Farrell, mom Kira, played by Jodie Turner-Smith, and daughter Mika, played by Malika M. You know what? I have a gift for you here. I only include this in the episode, not because I can't pronounce this child's name, because I phonetically looked up how to say it, but because this video from her audition tape is so unbelievably charming that I want everyone to hear it.
It's Malaya Emma Chandra Wijaya. I know that's a long name, so you can call me Malaya.
Isn't she adorable?
She's great.
She's so good. Cute. Love her. She's great in the movie. But yeah, and then daughter Mika, played by Malaya Emma Chandra Wijaya. And right at the start of the movie, the Fleming's lifelike live-in robot Yang malfunctions terminally. Yang, played by Justin H. Min, is a synthetic second sibling designed for the express purpose of helping the adopted Mika have a connection to her Chinese heritage. Jake's attempts to get Yang repaired lead him to exploring the replicant's secret internal memory banks, changing Jake's perspectives on the bot, his family, and his own relationships and recollections. The movie also stars Haley Lou Richardson as Yang's secret friend Ada, Richie Koster as a conspiracy-obsessed robot repairman Russ, Sarita Chowdhury as a robot museum curator Cleo, and Clifton Collins Jr. as next-door neighbor and father of cloned daughters George. And as previously mentioned, you can watch this movie on the Showtime or rent it on your VODs. As of this recording, it is a $1.99 rental, and it is more than worth your $1.99 and your 2 hours. So before I get into what I love about it, Jamie, tell me all your thoughts on my beloved After Yang.
First, very much like it. It's soft and it's intimate and it deals with some difficult concepts, but it deals with them pretty gently. I love Colin Farrell's performance. I think he's a huge standout. I think that Malia Emma Tendra Wijaya also pops in this movie. I wish I saw more of what's the mom, the actress that plays the mom,
Jodie Turner-Smith.
I wish there was more of her.
Gosh, she's amazing, isn't she?
She's really
incredible,
really
presence.
I felt like there were some threads, like Colin Farrell's relationship with her, and also the exploration of who Yang is and his relationships that could have been fleshed out a little bit more. Like, it was a really tight movie. But, like, I was left wanting more of the family stuff. We veered heavily in the direction of Yang and his relationships.
Which is part of the family stuff, though.
Right.
Because Yang is part of the family.
I understand that. But, yeah. Like, there's also, like, you're contending with how do you behave after Yang? And what are the relationships that still exist here? And I felt like, in particular, the husband and wife relationship was a little bit shortchanged. That's like it's a little beef that I have.
It's a minor grievance.
It's a minor grievance.
Yeah.
I don't think the movie is bad in any way. And I finished it, you know, smiling and really, really loving the movie.
Really? I find the last shot kind of chilling.
The last shot was.
So, all right. So first of all, if you're listening to this and this movie that we've described sounds appealing to you, stop this recording right now. Go and plunk down your $1.99 or sign up for some Showtime if you don't have it already and watch it After Yang and then come back. We'll still be here. We promise.
We promise.
We promise. Okay, great. You're back now. Spoilers for After Yang. All the spoilers. All of them. Which is, it's not like a super plotty movie, but no. Like there's some shit that goes down.
Yeah.
So the last shot of the movie is after Jake and Kira have decided that they don't want to put Yang on display in the museum, right? But that they think that his memories are important and that they should be archived, but that they don't want to display him in the museum. And then we're back in the living room and Jake is sitting there late at night by himself. And then Mika comes out and sits there with him and the two of them have like a little chat. And it's a static wide shot of the two of them sitting there looking straight into the camera. And then what happens? It freeze frames and slowly starts to zoom in, which is a motif that we had seen repeatedly at the end of all of Yang's memory videos that we saw.
Ah.
And so I don't think it's a twist ending. It's not like, you know, the end of Blade Runner. Oh, Harrison Ford's really a replicant the whole time. It's not that, but it's just like really quickly and sort of elliptically underlining that we're not talking about robots. We're talking about what is the nature of our own memory and our own relationships and what are we going to recall and how are we going to contextualize the experiences that we had along the way. But it just like it chilled me in sort of a strange way. And because it has a bit of a surveillance quality, that look. Well, so like the freeze frame and then the slow zoom in.
Right.
And also it unseats you. Like it brings Yang's recorded memory perspective into the room in a way that you didn't think was there for prior to that in that conversation.
Yeah. Well, it pays off a little bit the nods that we get to the surveillance state vis-a-vis the paranoid repair guy, whatever his name is. Russ.
Russ the repairman.
Who is like a self-avowed conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
You get the sense that it's kind of known that the bad shit that he's upset about is going on. Everyone's just kind of like okay with it. Scott is now holding up his cell phone and looking at me insistently.
Yeah.
Which is true. Yes.
Did you not relate to Russ at all?
Of course
people
I did.
Roll their eyes at fucking Russ and it's like, oh no. Yeah, there's a synthetic, you know, Silicon Valley, essentially like assistant servant robot who lives in your house. And nobody wants to listen to Russ when he says that it's recording everything that you're saying and that we found the secret memory banks inside. And so it's recording you and all of your family. Like, yep, sure. Checks out.
Yep.
Definitely makes sense, Russ. This is chilling and no one seems to care.
Nobody minds because it is just the thing. The only thing that they're worried about is that this company might get litigious.
Right. That's all anybody cares about. Is getting sued by Robot Apple.
That for me would be the reason that the last shot of the movie is chilling, but also like it's a nice family scene and you resolve all the points and they make a decision about how to pay respect to Yang and how they want to remember him as a member of their family.
Yeah.
And I think all of that is really beautiful.
So here's the other thing, and this is why it chilled me. This was my initial impression of that last shot and why it unsettled me so much. So like you said, they make a decision for how they want to pay respects to Yang, right? Like they're going to donate him to the museum, or they're going to donate the archive of his memories to the museum, but they don't want them displayed because it's private and that's Yang's like personal recollections, right? And we reveal Yang has lived multiple lifetimes essentially because he's a hand-me-down Chinese immigrant child integration robot essentially.
He was certified refurbished.
Right. They decide that they don't want his body displayed, and then that last shot from that fixed position and then to have it suddenly have the memory frozen zoom in. I had this thought, and again, like it's not a plotty movie. I do not think this is the intended twist, but my initial gut reaction was like, oh, they have like a Yang's bust is just mounted in the living room in the place of where like a TV might go. And he's just watching all of them and he's still recording somehow.
That is a read of that.
Which is not what is, it's not the text of the movie, but it got in my brain and it distressed me. But I don't think Jake would do that. And I think Mika would never come in that room ever again.
No, Mika would be horrified
if Yang
by
was
it.
Mounted under the mantelpiece.
Another small gripe that I have with the movie, this is a little bit bigger, is that like it contends with Mika's grief, but it doesn't really contend with her parents' grief. It's them troubleshooting how to deal with hers and not really feeling their own so much.
No, except for those two scenes, like the two key memory scenes. So we have Jake remembering, like he watches Yang's memory of the two of them when Yang is like asking Jake about tea and his obsession about tea. And that scene that I love where Jake just like drops that pitch perfect Werner Herzog voice talking about the documentary about tea.
It's so good.
Incredible. But so you have that scene. And then at the end of it, when and what I love about all the memory scenes is the way that it plays with subjectivity. Like we'll see Yang's objective recorded memory point of view intercutting with Jake's memory, and that we'll have repeats of lines and of takes, and it shows
in different
like,
ways.
Yeah. And it just shows the way that like in your memory, you can emotionally put the thumb on the scale of how you remembered somebody saying something or how you remember your own behavior. We get that in that scene with Jake. And then later when Kira is watching Yang's memories of a scene with the two of them talking as well. And it's the both of them. I think it's confronting their own grief as well. They didn't realize that they were grieving is the thing.
Yeah.
Until they saw his memories and saw, here's how he looked at us.
I think it's talking about our perception of memory more than it's talking about grief. And maybe there could have been a little bit more to say about how these people who may have not thought out loud to themselves that this was a member of their family, you know, begin dealing with something as like best case a dead pet, worst case an appliance, and then sort of grow into the idea that he was a family member through their daughter's grief. There could have been more. I was left wanting a little bit more of that also.
Mm.
But those little, you know, gripes aside, I really love how Russ's character is sort of wiped aside and his conspiracy theories are just like, they are said, it is known, and we don't really, like, we're not concerned with the corporate culture or the surveillance state or any of that. We just kind of know that it exists in this world. I like that the family unit still exists, and there's this beautiful, supportive family unit that they have, even though it is like a little bit dysfunctional and you see the cracks in the pavement, especially between Jake and Kira.
Well, I mean, and you know, just like her trying to tell Mika that, oh, daddy's really busy at the shop today and he's working real hard. And then we cut to the tea shop that no one is going into.
Yep.
And he's just fucking sitting there all day, possibly to avoid coming home.
Yep.
And like having to face the fact that like, oh, my tea shop is failing. And I am wasting my family's time and resources.
I really loved the scene. So the pair of scenes, and they're not right next to each other, but they're the first scene that you see of him in the tea shop, you have a Karen complaining to him about how he doesn't have tea crystals.
That's not fair. That She's lady's not a Karen.
Absolutely a Karen. She is
didn't
being,
ask for the manager. She just wanted tea crystals.
And just complains about how could this is a tea shop. How could you not have tea crystals? And doesn't even refuses to engage with him on any level. Is basically just like fuck you and walks out.
Doesn't make her a Karen. She just like walked into the wrong tea shop.
Right, but she could be like, oh, I'm sorry, I'll go somewhere else, rather than being a huffy pain in the ass.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe he could like get with the times and sell some fucking tea crystals.
That's the next scene. Like a couple of scenes later, you see him trying tea crystals.
Yeah.
He like pours yellow powder into hot water and he tastes it and nothing is said about it, but you can, Colin Farrell's performance is perfect. You can see how he like enjoys it and then gets mad that he's enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, this is a good product. Fuck.
Well, yeah, he enjoys the taste, but he misses the ritual and all the superficial esoteric stuff that he gets to fucking pride himself on and pat himself on the back. He misses the story of tea. He misses all of the terroir of tea.
Stop it.
He misses all the bullshit about tea that's so important to him and he thinks makes him better than other people who just want to drink some Franzia, Jamie. Now, there's a little parable that I just told right there.
A little bit, but I've definitely had that experience where I taste something that I have a preconceived notion about that I think is bad. That moment of like, oh, fuck. There's a reason why this is so successful. It tastes good. Does it have a place in my life or in my business or at the very least in the discourse?
And that moment was when Jamie watched Thor Ragnarok.
I don't know when exactly that first moment was, but it continues to happen. You know, I'll taste things that I dismiss and really find myself compelled by them or at the very least understanding why they're an important part of the conversation. And I like to think that Jake brings tea crystals into his shop as an act of contrition and a way of making some fucking money while he indulges himself in the ritual and all of the cool shit about tea.
But do you think he actually does? It's a very enigmatic ending. Like, our characters go on these, like, profound emotional journeys, especially once, like, Jake finds out about Yang's former life and the way that, like, Yang had a whole prior existence and this whole, like, huge dramatic arc that was recorded in basically, like, fucking TikToks in, like, one-minute segments every day.
And as a result, he basically gets over his racism of clones.
Yep.
And he, like, feels bad when his neighbor's daughter is pissed at him.
Yeah.
Rightfully so.
Yeah.
Like, he shows remorse. It's quite the journey they all go on.
Yeah. But you don't really know what the end place is for them. Like, it alludes to them. I just love how elliptical it is. Like, that last one of the, I think it's only three shots in the movie with a moving camera, and they all have trees. But in that last one where he's walking in the forest with Ada, and then the camera, the two of them, like, walk behind a tree while they're talking, and then only Jake emerges.
Yeah.
Exquisite bit of poetry, not really explained. You kind of understand what it's about. Like, he's walking with Ada, but maybe he's actually walking with the ghost of her ancestor that she's a clone with, or he's walking with a memory, like Yang's memory of Ada, or he's reviewing some memory of Yang's walking with her. Like, you don't need to know what it is, but I just love that it just allows for uncertainty and for the kind of beauty that can come out of uncertainty like that.
Yeah, I agree with that. And you can talk all day about where these characters might end up. You know, my hope is that Jake, you know, builds a better relationship with the clone community that exists in this time period, that he brings tea crystals into his shop and is more inclusive in that way as well, and that he's able to relate better to his daughter in the absence of Yang due to his better understanding of her now, and also is more open and honest with his wife due to, like, feeling the comfort of doing that thing in the middle of this movie. Because in the beginning, like, during his investigation, he's hiding things from her for no reason, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
He's just, like, going about his investigation and leaving her out of it. And I'm like, that's your partner, dude. Like, she's the mother of your child, and you're just not telling her this relevant information that, by the way, has no bad connotations to you or anybody, just, like, to hide it from her. And then he's
playing a little secretly.
Then he comes around and, like, brings her in, and you can feel like sort of a dam break in their relationship, and they're close again. And I think that that's really beautiful too.
I feel like the lying is maybe about him just not wanting to cop to how invested he is in Yang. You know, at that point, he's really just thinking about it as, like, I need Yang back because I need a babysitter for Mika.
Also, he's hung up on having spent so much money on Yang in the first place.
Yeah, even though he bought him secondhand.
Right.
But yeah, I concur with you. It we don't really understand his reasoning for things, though his reasoning seems questionable at times. We've talked around it a little bit. What do you think of the world building? Because I love how entirely backgrounded it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like it doesn't have to fill the background with things to explain to you, like, how we got to the future that we're in. But if you pull on any of those threads, there's, like, a compelling world behind all of them.
Yeah, there's a garden in the cars.
In the cars. The self-driving cars all are garden. That is where I came to this from the results of climate change.
It
just seemed that, oh, okay, there's something wrong with the atmosphere, and we need gardens and cars to generate enough breathable oxygen inside our self-driving vehicles.
I just kind of figured, like, this is the future that is obviously touched by the bad things that we're seeing right now. But yeah, that specifically, great. You know, we're getting ahead of ourselves. We can talk about the pairing in a little bit. But yeah, I think the world is fleshed out just enough.
Yeah.
You know, you can feel the influence of Asian culture in a huge way. And you can see that, you know, maybe one of the reasons that they adopted a Chinese child is because of the dominance of Chinese culture worldwide. Maybe.
See, I assumed it was because of some horrific calamity in China.
Which, right. And you can read it either way.
Yeah. But it just suddenly there's, like, a humanitarian crisis and we all better start adopting Chinese babies.
But the fact is, like, there is Chinese culture throughout this movie. There's Japanese culture throughout this movie. I'm not well schooled enough on the other Southeast Asian cultures to have like pinpointed them in the frames, but I wouldn't be surprised if they were also present.
Yeah, I mean, you can see it in the architecture and in the foods that they eat and
in the wardrobe
throughout. Yeah. So Koganada had said that he didn't want to do a dystopian future and he didn't want to do a utopian future. I guess he just wanted to do like a topian future. He was just like, yeah, like I just assumed that, you know, terrible things will continue to happen. But, you know, people are just going to keep on living and they're going to keep living their daily lives. And it's not going to feel like the Terminator or something. You know, I appreciate that in a future vision where it's just people just living on and you can sense that the world has changed in some pretty profound ways. And yet their day to day lives are recognizably human.
I guess we have at some point have to talk about as well.
Do we? Have to talk about your T word?
Listen, man. They
straight up talk about T word.
They don't say the word.
Yeah.
But they say, like, is this a thing that is capable of expressing a place and a time?
Right. Well, between the movie's whole interrogation into, like, a constructed Asianness, which for Koganada is, like, what drew him to the material. He is South Korean born, American raised, has lived here his whole life. Koganada itself is a pseudonym that he's taken on, and it's him putting together two Japanese phonemes for like different, I forget the exact details of them, but they're specific like recurrent Japanese imagery or themes that he has found in the work of Ozu, who is like a beloved like 1950s and 1960s Japanese filmmaker that Koganada has done video essays about.
Wow.
But yeah, like he says that he has like an American name that he just doesn't feel reflects him at all. So he's very private. And when he publishes things or when he makes movies, it's under
Koganada. The
pseudonym, lowercase k, Koganada. But yeah, for him, a lot of what drew him to it was the idea of a constructed Asianness. And that like Mika, Chinese born, but then growing up raised to American parents. And then they get this robot who has like himself a constructed Asianness. Like he yep. looks like he is Chinese and has all of these Chinese fun facts built into him. But then his Asianness is entirely synthetic.
And he laments it.
He does.
He out loud is like, I have all of these facts, but I wish I had some tangible connection to that place.
But then, I mean, there's that. And then there's like explicitly, they very nearly say the damn T word in that beautiful little flashback when he's talking about the grafting and about the vines.
Yep.
And he's trying to like give Mika some kind of understanding about like how she can be taken from a place and put on another family and still be connected to both of them. And he uses the grafting of a tree as a metaphor. Yeah,
this scene is in a grove of apple trees.
Yeah.
And if you don't know, it's very common practice to graft apple varieties, like eating apple varieties onto differing rootstocks in order to increase survivability, depending on climate or increase fruit productivity or whatever the case may be. Yang shows her a like just made graft, which looks as she points out, just like a branch stuck into a tree and wrapped with plastic wrap. But then he shows her the same thing that has grown into a full branch and how she is that branch grafted onto a tree that has roots that go into the soil.
It's magic.
It's fucking beautiful.
We have a weeping cherry out yonder here, and it's kind of special to look at. You can just like clock it from across the yard.
You can see the graft. And then there's also the scene where Yang is tasting tea with Jake, and they talk about, you know, what it is about tea that really captivates Jake. And Jake talks about, you know, the stories, and he talks about the ritual, and he talks about, you know, the translation of a place and a time into a substance that you imbibe. And Yang clearly doesn't quite get it.
I feel like Yang, Jamie. I really do. Not just like Yang, like not understanding the metaphor, but also like, because Yang can't actually, like, it's like he takes a little drink, but like you hear like clunking and whirring inside of his torso. But like he's clearly not processing the aesthetics of flavor or smell.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Yang sometimes. Is this a sweet wine or a dry wine, Jamie? Clunk, clunk, clunk. Whir.
Scott, I want you to know that if you malfunction and die on me, I will not have your body displayed in a museum. But I will allow them to analyze your memories.
Well, that's fine. I've been recording only the shittiest and most cancelable things you've ever said, Jamie, and I'm getting them ready to upload to fucking Twitter the moment I pass.
I had a great time with this movie. Obviously, it touches on a lot of things that I love. Oh, we didn't talk about the ramen scene.
Well, I mean, there's a couple scenes where they eat, but the ramen scene over Skype in particular, I find really striking.
Really, really striking, because it's at a moment where...
it's like the peak of tension in the marriage.
Yep. And yeah. You're like, what is happening between these two people? They like we're introduced to them, and it seems like they're in love, and they're like good parents and all of these things. And then you reach this point in the movie, and they are separated, and there's distrust, and there's concealment, and there's all of this, like, there are barriers in between them, and then here they are eating the same thing separately over video chat.
Yeah, like, she's either in her office or she's at home, and he's at a restaurant.
Because he's, like, hot on the trail of whatever new Yang.
Yeah, trying to crack the case of what is the mystery of Yang's robot processor parts inside. He tries to make a connection, like, oh, that's funny, we're both having ramen, but, like, nope, she's not having it, dog. She's even kind of mad at him that he's like eating a meal, and it's like, oh, he's got a, you know, it's an excuse to be mad at him. Like the problem is that, why aren't you here with your kid? Like, the important thing isn't to fix the robot. The important thing is to like be here with your daughter. But yeah, it's this like significant shared meal over a Skype situation where they're both looking like Jonathan Demme style, like directly down the barrel of the lens. And it's very intense and uncomfortable.
Very uncomfortable. And also an anachronistic product placement in there, too. The beer he's drinking.
What beer is he drinking?
He's drinking Stillwater Sake Saison.
Do they not have that in the indetermined, not too distant future?
I can't imagine that it's still around in exactly the same packaging that it currently is in 2020.
Man. Nostalgia, baby. If they can record all the robot memories, then packaging freezes.
I really like that beer. It's
Coke
good.
Coke can basically hasn't changed in 100 years.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. But Stillwater is not Coca-Cola. Stillwater is like an artisan brewery that's not... I mean, that particular beer is made in some quantity, but not like Coca-Cola quantity.
All right, Jamie.
And it's not a thing that you've ever heard of or that you even clocked on the screen.
This feels like a nitpick.
It's very much a nitpick. I'm interested to know like what the monetary deal was there to get that beer on camera. I mean, it fits the aesthetic very well. That beer makes sense as a part of this world.
I'm glad you liked it. I had a feeling you would. This is like one of my very favorite types of movies. It's like a smart, hard science fiction drama that's about the nature of being alive. And it's kind of a slow burn, and it's gorgeously crafted and very thoughtfully directed. That's just like a special subset of like favorites for me. Like, I would put this next to like Under the Skin or Ex Machina, or even something like Eternal Sunshine or Synecdoche, New York, or even like John Frankenheimer's Seconds. Something where like the sci-fi is just there as like seasoning, you know, it's not like Minority Report, like extensive world building future CGI backdrop sci-fi. It's just like it resembles the real world. And then there's just a 5% difference that tells you we're living in like a world that has been radically reshaped by something else. But yeah, I also just like, I love the way he directs. Like, truthfully, I wasn't really crazy about Columbus Coconata's first movie. I thought it was like, he directed the fuck out of a script that really didn't do it for me. But his direction, I just find, is so arresting. Like, we mentioned the subjectivity in the memory scenes is just so, like, it's him using editing and different aspect ratios and different visual motifs. Like, the difference between Yang's perspective and the human's memories is that the human memories, not only are the performances different, but it's a handheld camera. It's like the only handheld in the whole movie. There's just a looseness to it. And it's entirely suggestive and creates this impression for you that like, oh, I'm seeing two different versions of it and they're in conflict, and the conflict created by two different visual motifs or sets of tools being deployed differently creates a whole new meaning. Like, it's the best kind of film direction, where it's like using every tool in the box to create new levels of meaning and intent and emotion. I love how all of the aspect ratios that are used, because the movie uses four aspect ratios.
I did not even clock that.
You didn't notice the aspect ratio changing?
I did not, no.
Jesus Christ.
Wow, don't yell at me, Scott.
So most of
Stop yelling.
Most of the movie is, I'm sorry, it's, I don't think it's four. I think it's three aspect ratios. But so it's, most of the movie is like a scope 2:3:9, like widescreen, which on your television would have had black bars at the top and bottom.
Right.
And then the, all of the Skype scenes are something akin to like a 1:1 or like a 1.1:1, something close to like what we saw when we watched The Lighthouse, like a very tall boxy frame to replicate what video calling on one of these fucking horrible devices is like.
He's waving his cell phone
at me. They knew.
Again.
They knew.
He's been waving his cell phone at me a lot during this episode.
I'm just going to throw it out one of these days because it's poisoning my brain and trying to sell shit to me.
And I've got news alerts.
And Jamie's
online.
Just looking at his. He's not. I'm trying to talk here and he's not even listening.
The January 6th hearings, Scott. It's all over my phone now.
And then the actual, the stuff in Yang's memory warehouse, essentially his memory palace, like once they go in, and first just the exquisite simplicity of how they navigate the user interface of the memories, where it's just like it's constellations but also tree structures. But all of that is like a full, it's either a 185 or like a 178.
I didn't notice.
Like a full height frame. And so like all of those, it's a thing that like Koganada is interested in architecture, and not architecture just in terms of design, but in how shapes and spaces make you feel. And so like a narrow 2:3:9 aspect ratio feels contained. You feel trapped by it. A very tall aspect ratio feels almost too freeing. And like there's so much to the world. And when you compare that with something like a wide angle lens, like you can see so much of the world around you and it can almost feel overwhelming. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then something very boxy, like for the fucking ramen Skype call, can feel confining and it can feel too intimate and too personal. And there's no escape from it. Yeah. He's just like, he's great. And it's only his second fucking feature. I can't wait to see what this guy is going to do next.
Can we talk for a moment?
We have to talk about the opening. We didn't even talk about the opening of the movie yet.
No.
I'm surprised you haven't brought this up.
So we'll get to the opening.
All right.
But I would like to take just a moment.
Uh-huh.
Because you talking about the memory palace and all of that reminded me of that moment in the movie where he has to compress the two memory centers that we know about to open the older one.
Yeah, Yang's full human lifetime that he lived. Or full a human being's lifetime that he lived. Yeah.
With a whole other family.
Yeah. And then it's a universe of constellations that get unpacked.
And then the reveal that he knew Ada's clone mom.
Yeah.
The original Ada,
her,
so to speak.
Biological antecedent.
Sure.
Yeah. Ancestor. That's a word.
Yes.
Antecedent is also a
word. And I think that's appropriate. Ancestor implies sexual reproduction.
Right.
Which did
not happen. Right. Anyway, so you want to talk about that moment.
Well, it feels like it changes everything. Like that reveal just leads to a quickening of the pace and finding out the next thing and then like stitching back together the relationship that had been falling apart and like becoming open and honest again with his wife and unpacking grief with his daughter and getting a better relationship with clones, generally speaking. And like that moment felt, I don't even know how it communicates that pivot even before the quickening of the pace that I just described afterwards. He says open gamma or whatever it is. And that explosion of light is like, okay, this, now we've entered the final act of the movie. And I thought that was spectacular. And I don't really have the words to describe that. Do you have better words than I do?
Well, it's part of that, like that visual language of what the memory UI construct looks like. Every point of light is a brief video clip that Yang chose to record from that day. And we've already established that, like, the emotional impact that exploring each of those memories is having on Jake. And so then to unpack it, like, you're taking that visual grammar that you've already given the audience and the emotional and thematic associations and the character associations with them. And then you're exploding all of those by exploiting the things that like that visual mechanic can do. Like, yeah, it is kind of emotionally overwhelming because it just tells Jake and it tells the audience like, oh, all of this is just experience. This is all just so much life. And all of this meant so much to him and to the people that are like captured in these videos. Yeah, it's a turning point because you can feel it. Like they've done the hard work of explaining to you what all of that means so that moment isn't just imagery. Like right. the imagery has meaning baked into it already.
The density of the memories flying at you when he opens that memory vault, whatever, is even higher than the density that we had previously seen with this family.
Yeah.
And so you get the sense of like a truly full lifetime with a whole other family that he didn't get to have with the, what are their names? The
Flemings.
The Flemings.
Yeah.
I thought that was fucking beautiful. What about the opening?
Oh, just that it rules. Just that, like, and the opening is so not like what the rest of the movie is. The opening almost distracts you a little bit.
Yeah.
So the movie opens with a dance number, essentially, where like their family and the family of every character who you will see for the rest of the movie. It's basically like it's
interactive family TV game show
dance revolution, like group TV dance competition, but like everybody has a Xbox Kinect camera in their room but they're all dancing, trying in coordination. And they have like different colored backdrops behind all of them to like this super aggressive, like hyper pop electronic music that's going on. But we don't just see our hero family, the Fleming family. We see the next door neighbor family. We see George's family, and we see Sarita Chowdhury, who we only will meet like 45 minutes later. Cleo, the museum curator, yep. We'll see her family. We see Russ's family. Like, and it's this way of just like bringing all of these people together collectively, and it's beautiful, and it's high energy, and it's so gorgeous and infectious. And then the movie never has anything resembling that for the whole rest of it. It's so compelling to watch. And it is the only thing in the movie that sticks out like a sore thumb for me. I find it weirdly distracting, even though it's a gorgeous sequence on its own.
I don't think it's distracting, though, at all. I think it's in a similar way to Russ being a nod to the conspiracy theories that we know exist and the like the corporate espionage and the litigious nature of all of these companies or whatever. But we don't deal with that. This dance sequence is also a nod to the entertainment part of this world and how people pass time and how families now relate to one another.
Yeah, I'm fine with it as world building. I'm fine with it as text.
You're just talking about the aesthetic of it.
The actual aesthetic of it and the energy level that, not that the movie doesn't recover from like coming down from that energy level.
No, but it never gets back there. You're
right.
It's
just, it is so at odds with everything else that's going on in the movie. And while it's lovely and I enjoy it, I do find it a little bit strange.
It for sure is strange.
Yeah.
But the moment when they get eliminated.
And then Yang, and then that's when Yang shuts down.
Yeah.
That's when his fatal error happens.
Right as they're blaming Jake for fucking up the dance.
And nobody notices. And Yang is part of the family. It's special, man. I really like this movie. Yeah. I really like it a lot. I hope everybody at home watches along and enjoys it because it's real fucking good.
Yep.
And it like basically didn't do a theatrical release. Like it did, but it was like early 2022. So like Omicron was raging.
Kind of an art house
and the art houses have mightily struggled to have any kind of rebound post pandemic. And with exception of things like Everything Everywhere All at Once, which also played at all the fucking multiplexes too.
Right.
Yeah. This just like basically vanished from theaters and then very quickly went up through A24's deal with Showtime. And I'm glad that I got to see it that way, but it's like I just feel like it's a movie that film people and film critics talked about and that the general public just does not know it exists. And it's fucking beautiful. It's so good. Oh, we should talk about the pairing words and the pairing.
So before
we do the pairing,
okay,
yay or nay, the pairing words, you said crisp.
I did.
Do you agree that this movie is crisp? I find crispness in the photography.
I was about to say, in that way, yes. For sure.
The image making is crisp.
And the lockdown nature of the camera allows for those like clean lines everywhere.
It's clean lines. There's not that it's super high contrast, but like it's just very nicely framed images and like clean silhouettes that are
also the
bright light
Japanese aesthetic in the backgrounds and everything. Like that has a starkness that can be read as crispness.
Yeah. Mineral.
It's a tough one to translate to on screen.
So this is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to be more not direct one-to-one parallels in my pairings to the words that you're saying about the wines, and I am trying to do things that might complement them.
Right.
And I feel that there is a je ne sais quoi minerality about this movie, that, or something about it that would reflect well with minerality. Like, a lot of the architecture isn't stone. Like, it almost looks like poured concrete. Like, Jake's store is just like poured concrete. And a lot of the construction of the house, is like beautiful, like Spartan, like hardwood and large glass windows and doors, and then like poured concrete walls. And this is not that, but I don't know. They're minerality, I guess, in wines, at least, I associate with austerity sometimes. And not that this is an austere wine, but this is an austere movie.
I agree with that. Well, some of the visuals are austere.
I would say much of the movie is austere, not the opening dance number, and not like something like the memory sequences, but in terms of how it divulges information to you and the restrained emotional tone, that feels austere to me.
I'll give that to you.
The effects of a warming climate, we already talked about it. There are things in the world building that you could unpack that would tell you whether or not, you know, the climate has warmed in the future of this movie.
Which I think it's pretty clear that it has.
Right. Joyful. There's not a ton of joy in the movie. The opening dance number, exuberantly joyful.
Yep.
And then the unpacking moment when he unrars or you know,
unzips
or uncompresses the gamma file. Yeah. There's joy and there is beauty throughout there.
There's a joy in the memories that we get to see with Yang and Mika.
A lot of them are bittersweet, but there is joy to them.
Like that. Yes, it's bittersweet, but like going back to the grafting discussion, like her beginning to understand both what grafting is and how it can relate personally on her own journey. There is an amount of joy in there.
She also just has good kid energy.
She's got
like,
great
kid energy. She's not a precocious child performance. She's just like, she's a kid,
yep.
And there is joy and a twinkle in her eye kind of infused throughout the whole thing.
Yep.
Grassy fields. I mean, there's some imagery of grassy fields in the movie, whether it's in some of Yang's like pivotal emotional flashbacks or Jake and Ada walking through grassy fields and the trees towards the end, or even just the plants that are in the cars, the grass that's like packed in throughout the cars. These are the reasonings that I went for this movie from this wine, these wine words.
From these words.
But do we think it works?
So
one of
the things that resonates with me between this wine and this movie is the all of the tea imagery and the tea making and all of that, and the Japanese aesthetic of the specific teas that he's making. Recall for me like Japanese sencha, which for me is so very grassy. Specifically, sencha is like a flavor note that I often pull out from Sauvignon Blanc. I think it's a little bit in this wine as well. And I think that kind of, there's a direct resonance there. And then the brightness, the acidity of this wine and pairs, I think, well with the happy moments of like when Yang is there with them. And then also the explosion of the uncompressing moment. It's not the best pair. It didn't blow my mind, but I think it works.
I think it sits nicely next to the movie.
Yeah.
I don't think it doesn't pair. I don't think it's super like, it's not an outstanding pairing, but there's stuff. There's corollary. It's complementary. It's not distracting.
Right. As we were talking about with the food, you know, one of the things that I look for in a good pairing is like, does the combination of the two effectively change one or the other? And I don't really think that happens so much here.
Well, how did you know? Did you have this wine while watching the movie?
Yeah.
Oh, I did not. Well, take it up with FedEx, Jamie, all right? I was waiting 2 days for this shit to show up.
It was FedEx's fault. Yeah, the two bottles that I had shipped to your place came late, and the one bottle that I went out and bought in New Jersey, I, you know, drove across to Jersey and bought it, and they only had one fucking bottle at that store, and I was very upset.
But here we are.
Here we are.
Yeah, I think I feel like it's fine. It's a 6 out of 10 pairing.
I'm comfortable with 6 out of 10.
It's the barest minimum for success. Good movie, good wine. Maybe you find some kind of parallels between them.
And the warming climate thing.
Well, that's your favorite way to pair, which is just with fucking metaphor and stories and bullshit. Nothing to do with what's in the glass.
Listen, man, It's hard out here.
All right. I'm just saying, if you ever went back to restaurants and chef gave you the fucking fall menu, and then you come up with your wine pairings and they're like, what the fuck is all this? And you're like, well, you know, I really thought that this reflected. I really like that you picked beef and that, you know, there was this
Listen,
wine that I really liked.
You're mocking this shit, but this is literally how restaurants work.
That they like and pairings like, based on narrative and not flavor.
There is a lot of that that goes on. And a lot of it that is quite compelling when you're experiencing a great meal in a restaurant and someone is telling you a good story about both the food that you're eating and the wine that you're drinking.
But don't you also want the pairing to work aesthetically?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, then fine.
Yeah.
But then that's what's important. Then that's what's important.
They're both important, Scott.
I think one of them is important, and the other one is the story about the thing.
The story is important.
The story behind the thing. It's not even about the thing.
Yes, it is. It's about the thing.
Okay. All right.
You got wife takes?
I do not. I have wife retractions.
Wife retractions.
Oh, God. She got a fucking diagram and everything.
Oh,
all right.
Oh, my God.
So, from wife of mine.
Does she know that this is an auditory medium?
Do you know that it's an auditory medium, Jamie?
I don't know that, but I'm asking if she does.
She is aware. I think the diagram maybe is for your benefit, but I'll have to read the key to you.
Send it to me?
Yeah. So wife of mine, Tani, on a recent episode, I put her on the spot because you said that smell and taste are the same thing. And I said, no, that's stupid.
Yep.
And so I texted her because she's a double scientist, both a doctorate in pharmacy and a bachelor's in science in neurology. And she texted back and sent me some stuff, and she has corrections to make here. Slight correction. The sense of smell bypasses the thalamus, not the hypothalamus. In my defense, A, I wasn't paying that much attention in the moment, and B, I'm definitely still right that smell and taste get processed a little bit differently. I think the important thing to note here is that she was not aware when I was texting her that this was going to end up in the show. She says that broadly speaking, taste goes from the receptors in the tongue via various nerves to the medulla oblongata, to the thalamus, to the gustatory cortex. Smell goes from the olfactory receptors to the olfactory bulb to the olfactory cortex, bypassing the thalamus, as mentioned, which is why smell and memory are so viscerally connected. They do both end up feeding into many of the same higher-level functions, but they do have that critical and fundamental difference in processing. She provides an article that I can read out loud to Jamie later and give him some crayons to play with, and there's a diagram. And while she didn't write it here, she did want me to stress to you that the most important thing here is that while she was wrong in some of the details, the important thing is that you were wrong all over. Smell and taste, not the same. Science.
Sure. I concede.
Wow. That has never happened before, ladies and gentlemen, at home. So, James, Philadelphia tasting menu.
Yes, indeed.
Part 2 of 6.
Part 2.
Where are we going? What are we eating? I'm hungry.
You're hungry already? We just had lunch.
That was hours ago.
3.5 hours ago.
And I've been drinking.
Yeah, fair. Fair. So we're going to a little restaurant called Irwin's Upstairs, which is in the Bach building at 8th and Mifflin. So this is just a couple of blocks from my humble abode. The Bach building was once a high school in South Philly and now is, rents out commercial space. So there's a coffee shop in the bottom. There's a really great bakery down there. There's the Bach bar, which was the first, food and beverage outlet that opened in this building some years ago at the top of the building. And on the other side of the top of this building is Irwin's, which is a, Sicilian inspired Italian restaurant, from Chef Michael Ferrari, who was, prior to this, the executive chef at Res Ipsa, which was another very popular Sicilian-inspired restaurant. He tends to cook, as with most, if not all, of the chefs that I'm working with for this miniseries, in a way that is relatively simple and highlights great ingredients, and he's very much inspired by his family. So this is the next dish is his gnocchi sardi with eggplant and chili. And this is a dish that is very much cribbed from his grandmother and something that he ate a lot as a child.
So he's ripping off grandma's gnocchi recipe.
It's an homage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know what's fun about homages? You don't have to pay royalties for homages as long as you say, homage.
That's absolutely true, yes.
I got your back, Grandma. Don't you worry. Well, this sounds delicious. I haven't had some good gnocchi in a while.
Yeah, yeah. It's really, really good. And also the whole setup up at Irwin's, it's like a beautiful restaurant. It's on the top of this building and sitting on the outside space. You're just overlooking the south side of Philadelphia. And it's just, it's a wonderful experience.
What a gorgeous neighborhood to overlook.
You're just looking right at the Philadelphia airport.
Yeah.
You're, some 8 stories above. So everything looks romantic from...
On top of a prison / former middle school.
It's a school. It's not a prison.
It just looks like a prison. All right. And to go along with the gnocchi, Jamie, what are people drinking? You're the wine guy, not the wine guy.
So they're drinking? Bodega Chakra Barda Pinot Noir 2020. This is available at Crush Wine Company for $26. This is a little wine from Patagonia in Argentina, the southernmost area of Argentina.
From the New World.
From the New World.
And it's Pinot Noir. I'm very excited. All right.
Coming from old vines. And I told you that this wine was friendly, warm, historic, velvety or plush, and floral like roses.
Well, you picked a New World wine and I picked an extremely old world movie. Well, kind of. But it has nothing to do with the food. And I didn't know that this was from Argentina when I picked it. So don't hold this against me. We are watching Sofia Coppola's 2006 Marie Antoinette. This is a movie starring Kirsten Dunst as the iconic queen. And it's delightfully anachronistic. It's a romp. And it co-stars Jason Schwartzman as King Louis XVI, which should probably tell you an awful lot about what tone to expect from this movie.
I think I'm going to like this.
It also features an awful lot of borderline pornographic photography of exquisite French pastries, which is how the food connection comes in for my side of this miniseries.
Wonderful.
So as of this recording, Marie Antoinette, available to stream on The Who of Lou, and you should check it out.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you.
Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod, either Instagram or Twitter. Email us, should you have any concerns, comments, questions, at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. Please tell each and every one of your friends. If you're a listener outside the U.S. and you leave us a review on the Apple Pods, be sure to email it to us as well so we can read it on the air. Apple will only show us domestic reviews.
This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That's me. Our social media presence is thanks to Jamie. That's him.
That's me.
Jamie, just like Koganada, Madonna, Cher, Beyonce, Lil Kim. I guess Lil Kim is two names.
First name Lil, last name Kim.
Yeah. Anyway, Jamie, all one word now. That's the brand. Our art is thanks to Ross Connard. Thank you very much, Ross.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine, watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.